From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we tip our hats to Nick at Night and salute classic television. First, we meet the creator of The Dick Van Dyke Show, Carl Reiner. The show was based in part on Reiner's experiences writing for Sid Caesar's Your Show of Shows. Then we find out what it was really like to be rescued by Superman. We talk with Jack Larson, who played Jimmy Olsen, cub reporter for The Daily Planet. And we get the story behind Zelda Gilroy, the brainy girl who loved Dobie Gillis. The actress who played her, Sheila James Kuehl, recently became the first openly gay person to be elected to the California State Assembly. Also today, film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Just Cause, starring Sean Connery and Lawrence Fishburne. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. A jury is deciding the fate today of the man who shot six people to death on a New York commuter train and wounded 19. The panel got final instructions yesterday from the judge on Colin Ferguson's trial. Ferguson has acted as his own lawyer during the case. He used his closing arguments to describe himself as the victim of a conspiracy between police and the survivors of the December 1993 shootings. The nation's trade deficit shot up 43% last year, according to figures released today by the Commerce Department, but the monthly deficit fell in December. That's a sign the trade balance may improve this year. NPR's John Itzty reports.
U.S. exports soared to record levels in 1994, but exports were swamped by the U.S. appetite for imports. For the full year, the trade deficit totaled $108 billion, the biggest trade gap since 1988. The U.S. had a record deficit in the trade of goods, such as automobiles and steel, but that deficit was partly offset by a surplus in the trade of services, such as tourism and business consulting. Growing trade deficits with China and Japan were big contributors to the wider trade gap. The main reason for the higher deficit last year was faster growth in the United States than in the rest of the world. That increased the U.S. appetite for imports. Analysts expect faster growth in the rest of the world this year will help push the trade deficit down. However, Mexico's economic problems dampen the prospects for improvement. I'm John Idste in Washington.
An Ohio man convicted of firebombing a Cincinnati clinic that performs abortions in 1985 is out of prison. Lorna Jordan of member station WVXU reports.
John Brockoft was released from an Ashland, Kentucky prison before dawn today after serving 4 years of his 7-year sentence. He pleaded guilty to setting fire to Cincinnati's Planned Parenthood clinic in 1985. Planned Parenthood of Cincinnati officials were so concerned about Brockoft's release that they asked for and received restrictions on his parole. He will also be placed on electronic monitoring. The government says Brockoft could not be kept in prison because he served the required time. Planned Parenthood says Brockoff's release will not stop it from providing reproductive health care. For National Public Radio, I'm Lorna Jordan in Cincinnati.
First Lady Hillary Rodham Clinton says she and the president are fully prepared to cooperate with a special investigator in the Whitewater case. Mrs. Clinton says the couple will cooperate in every way. She shook her head when she was asked today if the Clintons had been asked to give special testimony to the Whitewater special counsel. Federal investigators have opened a probe into yesterday's crash of a cargo plane at Kansas City International Airport. All three crew members died. The plane had no cargo aboard, but it was carrying thousands of pounds of fuel, which was ankle to knee deep near the crash site. On Wall Street, the Dow was down 25 points at 3,962. This is NPR. Black veterans of World War II are being honored today in Washington. President Clinton is to join a salute to the veterans, which is being hosted by the Defense and Veterans Affairs Departments. The salute comes one day after Navy Secretary John Dalton issued a belated commendation for the crew of the USS Mason. The destroyer's mostly black crew performed heroic service during a convoy across the Atlantic. Commendations had been recommended at the time for the crew, but they were not done. The U.S. has opened the door for Poland and other Eastern European countries to buy high-technology American weapons. The offer includes aircraft like the F-16 fighter jet. NPR's John Greenberg reports.
The potential arms sale is part of a new security agreement between the U.S. and Poland. Defense Secretary William Perry said the agreement also calls for joint military training exercises. He said Polish defense officials will receive a briefing on the F-16. Administration officials said other countries that would be allowed to buy high-tech weapons include Hungary, the Czech Republic, and Slovakia. Allowed is the operative phrase. These countries would be hard-pressed to come up with the cash to pay for expensive new F-16s. However, there is some chance they might be offered used planes. The U.S. and NATO have been courting the Eastern European countries. This latest move is likely to trigger a protest from Russia. There, President Yeltsin has spoken against steps to draw former members of the Eastern Bloc into the Western alliance. This is John Greenberg in Washington.
South African President Nelson Mandela says his government lacks the funds to raise salaries and improve living conditions. Mandela says strikes and protests to back demands for wage increases will not create the resources the government needs. South Africa has seen increasingly militant strikes by police, public workers, and others. There's been increased worry over labor unrest. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. I don't know about you, but with the help of Nick at Night, I've become more of a Dick Van Dyke fan now than I ever was before. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we have an interview with the creator of the show, Carl Reiner. The show, of course, starred Dick Van Dyke as a writer for a variety show whose host, Alan Brady, was played by Carl Reiner. Last night on Mad About You, Reiner guest starred as Alan Brady. Carl Reiner got his start in TV in 1950, playing second banana to one of TV's first big stars, Sid Caesar. Reiner also wrote for Caesar's hit variety show, Your Show of Shows. Reiner's film credits include roles in The Russians Are Coming and It's a Mad, 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 Mad World. He directed the movies Enter Laughing, Oh God, and Where's Papa, as well as the Steve Martin films The Jerk, Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid, The Man with Two Brains, and All of Me. I spoke with Carl Reiner in 1989. You did your show of shows. You were one of the stars of it. You were one of the writers on it. And it really turned into one of the most important shows in the history of television. Did you have any sense?
Well, it was the first of its kind, and luckily it was excellent. I mean, the first of its kind sometimes isn't revered. It's just that you break some ground. But this was the first of its kind, and it was peopled by extraordinary writing and performing talent. Max Liebman had a great eye for selecting people that might be stars someday. And he found Sid Caesar and Imogen Coca. Before that, he had worked with Danny Kaye, so he really had a good eye.
How did he find you?
He found me in a Broadway show. I was performing in a Broadway show, and the first full year of his show of shows was about to go on the air, and he needed somebody to support Sid Caesar. And I had been a first banana up until that time. I had been a leading comedian. And he invited me to become the second banana. When I had seen Sid in Tars and Spars and another venture on Broadway, Make My Manhattan. And I thought this guy was an extraordinary talent. And being a second banana to such a massive first banana wasn't a come down at all for me. I realized I was working with the best.
So being second banana to Sid Caesar, did he want to get all? Was he the kind of performer who wanted all the good lines for himself? Was he a hog in any way?
No, as a matter of fact, he was very good about the piece being right. And if you got a laugh, and if you did something funny, he would never say, oh, well, let me do that. He just lets you do it. As a matter of fact, Sid was the best double talker in the whole world. He'd double talk French, Spanish, German, Chinese, Japanese, what have you. And I also was pretty good at double talk, and I knew I would never get to do my double talk impressions. And so I came up with the idea of doing foreign movies. In the third week of the show of shows, that was on the air. The third week was on the air, and it was such a success. As a matter of fact, that's the way I became a writer without portfolio. Up to that time, I'd been just an actor, and now I was just an actor, but who had some ideas. So I was always in the writer's room from then on. We never got credit in those days for writing. Actors were actors, and writers were writers. But I did learn my craft working with those brilliant writers.
So you started hanging out with the writers and sitting in on all the writing meetings and contributing ideas.
Oh, it started in the third week, and it was 9 years of that. And I became actually a writer without portfolio. I considered myself a writer at that point because I worked on things that even was not going to be in. I worked on some of his monologues, and Mel Brooks and I did a lot of work on and Sid did on The Professor, where I asked him questions, which was actually the genesis of my asking Mel Brooks about the 2,000-year-old man.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That's another second banana roll that I relish.
In the writers' meetings for the Sid Caesar show?
Yes.
Was there ever an air of complete desperation where you had this whole room of really funny people, but they were just on the verge of killing themselves because they weren't coming up with what they wanted to?
Oh, I tell you, you're reminding me now of a moment when, after we'd been on about 2 or 3 years, and we had done 5 sketches a week for maybe 2 or 3 years, and that was an hour and a half show, and one day, on a Monday, we came in, and we sat around trying to fill some of the forms, and everybody came up blank. Everybody had dried up at the same time. And we all decided that was it. We said to Max Liebman then, we said, we're going to come on the air and just sit there, the four of us, Sid Caesar, Imogene Coke, myself, and Howard Morris, and just stare at the set. And then we'd go blank, and somebody would come and say, ladies and gentlemen, there is no more comedy. We have done all we can. No more. This is it. Good night. And we were going to do that. And we laughed about that. As a matter of fact, we decided to try a sketch where we started a sketch like vice president, people being ushered into a room, into a salon where they were going to obviously perform a sketch. One by one, they say, Lord Trickston, General so-and-so, they come in and they sit down on a couch and just sit there without doing anything. And we showed it to Max. We said, this is the sketch. We just sat there. And he said, what is that? What is that? We sat for 5 minutes. And of course, everybody broke up. They said, they're not going to do anything. They're just going to sit there. We said, that's it, Max. There's no more comedy. We couldn't come up with an idea. So we think we'd like to do that. America will tune in and say, they're just sitting there. They haven't moved in 5 minutes. One guy crossed his leg, and that was it. We were that desperate at that point. Of course, that week, we probably came up with the best show we ever did.
There were several of the writers on the program were Jewish. You, Mel Brooks, toward the end of the
Mel Brooks is Jewish?
That's a shock. Woody Allen worked on the show toward its end, and who knows who else I'm not mentioning here. But I was wondering if you were allowed to do Jewish characterizations, to have Yiddish words or to use a Jewish accent on the show.
I don't think we ever used a Jewish accent. I didn't know. After the war and during the war and before the war, it became, people decided that making fun of any ethnic group was not good for people who were being slaughtered by somebody who thought they weren't worthy of living. So we did use a lot of Yiddish words, especially in our Japanese movies. We did, I remember some of the names, Shtaka Yamagura. Shtaka meaning strong, but it had a Japanese sound to it. Baron Kashimoto. Kasha is a word, is a food. But we always, anytime we used a Jewish word, we didn't allow that to lay out there alone. We always had another joke that everybody who didn't understand the word would be watching at the same time that joke was happening. We were very responsible to our audience not to do inside jokes that only some people would get.
I bet there were a lot of Yiddish-type sketch ideas that you came up with behind the scenes that you ended up tossing out since it wasn't appropriate for TV.
Well, as a matter of fact, the 2,000-year-old man was in the office with us every day, and every time we got bored, I turned to Mel and I interviewed the 2,000-year-old man.
Oh, really?
Who basically was of the Hebrew persuasion. So we had that.
How did you come up with the idea for the 2,000-year-old man? What was the story behind that?
Well, it was a very simple story. I came in one morning, having seen something irresponsible on television, and somebody who actually claimed to have been someplace they couldn't have been, and I said, oh, that's a ridiculous thing. I don't know why they put that on the air. And in anger, I said to Mel, I understand you were actually at the scene of the crucifixion, sir. He said, oh, boy. And then started a 10-year interview that I did every time we got bored in the office. I'd turn to Mel and question about all the people he knew, having lived 2,000 years from Jesus Christ on to the present day.
Now, how did that end up being recorded and being done on television?
Well, we had done it for years at parties. We were always invited to parties, sort of like command performances, and we didn't feel we wanted to do that. We figured we had enough stature to be just invited to eat and talk, but I always brought a tape recorder with me, and I felt that I loved hearing Mel do this, and I wanted to have a record of it. So I had about 10 years of, maybe 10 years of this stuff before we got into a situation where Joe Fields, who was a big writer-producer on Broadway, he used to love it. And every time he'd have a party, invite Mel and I to do it. And he did it on the coast once, the West Coast. And every major star was there. And George Burns came up to us and said, you better put it on record or I'm going to steal it. Eddie G. Robinson came up. He says, make a Broadway play out of it. I want to play that man. And Steve Allen came up and said, why don't you put it on record? And we said, no, no. He says, why don't you let me pay for the tape? I have a little record company. If you don't like it, you can tear it, burn it, expunge it, whatever you want. And we did it. We did it in front of a crowd of 200 people, this whole ad-lib tape for 2 hours. We cut it down to 47 minutes, and it worked. And then we did 4 more albums after that.
Did you ever break yourselves up through an improvisation that you didn't expect?
Oh, all the time, because this was all ad-lib. The 4 albums we did were never prepared. We just went with an audience and just sat and chatted for 2 hours usually, and took the best of it. No, I was always off mic, giggling and stuffing handkerchiefs into my mouth, and sometimes not hearing because I was laughing. I didn't even hear what the second part was until I heard it back on the tape and then laughed again.
Let me ask you a little bit about the Dick Van Dyke Show. I've always assumed that the show was based on your experiences writing for and performing in your show of shows.
Did you come to that on your own, or did you read it someplace?
Because it's obvious.
No, but it was. Yeah, it was based on my life as a writer actor on the show of shows, and it was my home life fantasized and satirized and lied about. No, but basically, it was the husband and wife on the Dick Van Dyke Show was. My wife and myself. I mean, that's all I knew. I knew no other marriage intimately. We've been married 45 years, and at that time was about 20 or 30 years.
Did you ever trip over the divan on your way into the living room?
I'm a klutz. My wife, I didn't do that, but I don't know how many thousands of times I stepped onto the back of her scuffs while she was walking, and I was walking behind her and had her, trip forward. I think most men are klutzy in some areas. I mean, except for maybe Baryshnikov. I think Baryshnikov and Gene Kelly and Fred Astaire and Cary Grant never tripped. Although I did see Cary Grant trip once. We shared offices near each other, and I saw him coming out of his car and tripping on the curb all by himself. But he did such a graceful trip. He turned around like Cary Grant does, and he looked at what he tripped at and then sort of danced away from it. He was all by himself. But most people are klutzy, I think. Most men are klutzy. And I think it's an endearing quality we have that we are not totally graceful.
The Dick Van Dyke Show has become one of the really classic sitcoms from television. Was it nevertheless a difficult show to sell to the network after you had created it?
No, as a matter of fact, the network bought it right away. They knew the quality of the show, and they knew the performances were very winning. Our ratings the first year weren't the best because we were on opposite Perry Como, who was riding real high at the time, had a wonderful show, a variety show. And they were thinking of canceling us the second year because we were only half sponsored. But Sheldon Leonard, our executive producer, got the other half sponsored. And I voted for a very sort of dramatic thing that was not being done at the time, to rerun it during the summer. I said, people who didn't see us can sample us now. People who watched Perry Como can sample us. And it happened. They sampled us, and they stayed with us the following year and for the next 5 years.
How did you cast yourself as Alan Brady, the star of the show?
Why did I cast myself doing it originally?
Yeah, how did you cast yourself doing it? Yeah.
Oh, you mean Alan? Well, I was looking for a major star, and I knew I couldn't get a major star to play a major star by giving him so many small scenes to do. So I said, I got to find somebody who they would think was a star. And then I cast myself. I said, well, I was a second banana, but I was close to being a star. And the first year, I didn't turn around. I used the back of my head. I used myself on a phone or under a towel when I was being shaved or something. And I didn't show my face because I didn't want the audience to say, oh, is that the star? He's not big enough. But by the second and third year, the scripts got so elaborate, and they seemed to like Alan Brady, that I turned him around and showed who he was, and it turned out to be me, and nobody was terribly disappointed, so we stayed with it.
One last thing. Does writing comedy help make life any more enjoyable? Do things, can you put a comic spin on things in real life?
Oh, yes, because writing comedy and writing it successfully, having your pictures made and people laugh at it, you know what happens? They give you money for that.
Right.
And giving you, and you take that money, you buy a house, you buy a nice car, get good clothes, good food. Of course, when you get older, you can't eat the really good food. You got to eat the simpler food. But it does make life very pleasant.
Carl Reiner, recruited in 1989. He's completing a new novel called Continue Laughing, scheduled for publication next June. Coming up, the cub reporter for the Daily Planet. This is Fresh Air. My next guest spent his early career perfecting the line, "Golly, Superman."
Faster than a speeding bullet. More powerful than a locomotive. Able to leap tall buildings at a single bound.
Look, up in the sky, it's a bird.
It's a plane.
It's Superman. Yes, it's Superman.
From 1953 to 59, Jack Larson played Jimmy Olsen, cub reporter for the Daily Planet. Since his days of getting rescued by the Man of Steel, Larson has become a librettist, collaborating with such composers as Virgil Thomson, Ned Roram, Charles Fussell, and David Diamond. He's also produced several films, including Bright Lights, Big City, The China Syndrome, The Paper Chase, and Urban Cowboy, and he's written several plays. In 1993, Jack Larson told me that when he started writing operas, he didn't want the opera world to know that he co-starred in Superman.
I had kept it a secret. I hadn't talked about it because I felt if anybody knew that the Jack Larson that was writing the plays and working with eminent composers was Jimmy Olsen, that the sky would fall in on me like Chicken Little and I would lose my writing career, work, life, as well as my acting work life. So I never mixed the two. It happened. I got exposed as Jimmy Olsen.
How?
Through a ballet that I had written the text for called The Relativity of Icarus that had a lot of press in New York, and there was a press conference called by the Joffrey, and the Associated Press, the New York Post, when I appeared at this press conference, they knew that I was Jimmy Olsen, and they wrote about it, and I thought, oh, golly, you know, the sky is going to fall in on me. It didn't. And then I was asked to do, Tom Brokaw asked me to do the Today Show. And I did a number of things, and I felt this is going to be my ruin. And it wasn't, and it turned out that people were very happy for me that I wasn't lying in a gutter somewhere as an old actor out of work, you know.
Well, you were interested in writing, in serious acting, and here you were on Superman playing this golly gee whiz naive cub reporter. It sounds like you were really nothing like the character you were playing. Did you enjoy playing that kind of role? Did it get annoying after a while?
I loved playing Jimmy. And I now, all these years later, regard it as a fulfillment of myself as an actor. I think Jimmy was, it was my part. Being a pioneer in television like that, in film television, they were so busy technically learning how to film a show quickly that they let us all alone as performers. And they let me create Jimmy. And I wanted to do comedy and comedy bits, and they'd let me alone. And once I became popular, they really let me alone to just do what I wanted to do. So you were like a pioneer in the early days of silent films, a two-reel comedy, doing television.
How many times were you kidnapped as Jimmy Olsen?
Oh, I don't know, probably every third show I was kidnapped as Jimmy and had a bomb. If I was ever kidnapped, I was either tied to a chair with a bomb at my feet or sealed in a room somewhere that Superman couldn't see through because there was mysterious lead in the brick or something. But that never bothered me. What bothered me was the writers and the producers they liked to have Jimmy nearly drown. And they used to like to get me wet, like put me in a cave, and the tide is coming in the cave, and the cave has bars, and Jimmy is going to be drowned. This was a holdover, I guess, from the old Saturday morning serials, as I said. And the problem with that, I never mind being wet. I will do anything as an actor, but you get sick because once it gets you wet, if you've got work to do afterwards, you stay wet. And the next day work, if you're rescued, for instance, Superman would come in and rescue, tear back the bars of the cave and carry Jimmy out, who would say, "Golly, Superman, I never thought you'd get here in time. I thought I was a goner for sure." And I'd be carried outside dripping wet. Well, your next scenes, all your next work, the resolution, you're still wet. They come with a hose and wet you down. And I would always catch a cold. Sound stages are cold. And it drove me crazy. And they never cared. And I finally told them, it was about the second season and my 10th wet show. And I said, "Listen, I don't want to seem a spoil sport, but I don't like working sick. And I catch a cold in these cold sound stages, so quit. You can regard me from now on as a dry actor."
Years ago, it was just like the first year I was in radio, it was in the mid-70s, I think, I interviewed Noel Neal, your co-star. She was...
Oh, did you?
She was Lois Lane.
Yes, she's a darling person.
Well, one of the questions I asked her was this. I said, "I remember all these episodes where you were kidnapped and you were tied up and you were wriggling around while you were, you know, in bondage. And sometimes you'd be dressed in the chiffon robe and you were supposed to be sacrificed until Superman came and rescued you." And I said,
"Right.
You know, did you ever think about the kind of S&M type of image that was?" And she said, "We never thought about those kinds of things."
No.
Did you really never think about those kinds of things?
No, I really didn't. I know the show you're referring to, where the a ancient cult kidnapped both of us in a tomb, and they stripped me. I'm in like a jock strap or something, little thing, and she's in a beautiful filmy thing, and we're tied to pillars or something, and they're going to kill us. And I guess it was wild S&M. I don't know. No, I never thought about it. We were too busy working. We never thought about a lot of things, you know. I always played the Jimmy, dumb enough. I felt that Jimmy was so dumb that he couldn't tell Superman was Clark Kent because Clark Kent wore a pair of horn-rimmed glasses.
Right, right.
And I thought, if you're that unaware, and any kind of a thing. Once actually Clark Kent, there's one show where Jimmy's beside him, and Clark Kent has fallen through his shower door, and he's in bed, and Jimmy seems to be sharing the apartment at that time or something. He's taking care of him, and Clark Kent does not have on his glasses, and Jimmy doesn't even still recognize him as Superman. And I pointed it out to the director and the producer. I said, "Well, now, you know, here we are, and he doesn't have on these glasses because he's fallen through his glass shower door." And they said, "Oh, don't think about it. That's opening up a can of peas." Just play the scene, so I did.
Jack Larson, recorded in 1993. He's now collaborating with composer Ned Roram on a piece for chamber symphony and voice to be premiered by the L.A. Chamber Symphony. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Thank you.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Zelda Gilroy. She was brainy and assertive, but all she wanted to do was marry Dobie Gillis. Coming up on this archive edition of Fresh Air, we feature a 1992 interview with Sheila James Kuhl. She was the actress who played Zelda on The Dobie Gillis Show. Her acting career ended because of rumors she was a lesbian. She was. But the end of her acting career led to another career she liked even better. She became a feminist lawyer and ran the California Women's Law Center. Last November, she became the first openly gay or lesbian person to be elected to the California State Assembly. Also, film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Just Cause, the new thriller starring Sean Connery, Lawrence Fishburne, and Ed Harris. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The Mexican government has announced it will not pull back troops that occupied numerous towns in the state of Chiapas last week. The towns had previously been held by Zapatista rebels. NPR's David Wellner reports from Mexico City.
In a communique this morning, the Mexican government states categorically that army troops and federal police who moved into Zapatista-held territory a week ago will not be withdrawn. The Zapatistas, in an earlier communique, had said they were willing to resume peace talks with the government, but only if troops were removed from positions they'd occupied. The rebels, as well as many civilians, have retreated to mountain hideouts in the eastern part of Chiapas. On Tuesday, Mexican President Ernesto Zedillo ordered his forces to avoid any confrontation with the Zapatistas, and the controversial governor of Chiapas from the ruling party stepped down. A manhunt for the rebel leader known as Subcommander Marcos has been called off until Mexico's Congress approves an amnesty law, but a warrant for his arrest still stands. I'm David Walna in Mexico City.
A memorial service has been held today for four Army Ranger trainees. They died of exposure this week after wading and swimming through a cold swamp at Eglin Air Force Base in Florida. They were taking the Army's most rigorous training, intended to simulate harsh battle conditions. Military officials say the water was deeper than expected, and the soldiers were in it longer than planned. They say instructors with years of experience had determined it was safe to go on with the training. The deaths are being investigated by an Army safety officer. A report released by a national education panel says American high school graduates are not prepared to do better than C-level work in their first year of college math and science courses. The report was released today in Iowa City. Mark Moran of member station WOI reports.
The National Education Goals Panel released the latest report, which says only 11% of the students who have taken at least three math and three science classes in high school and plan to major in math or science in college are likely to achieve a B grade or better in their freshman year. High schools report a steady rise in the number of students taking college prep courses over the last several years, but education officials say under-preparation for college is still a large problem. The panel study cites particular shortfalls among students in their first year of algebra, chemistry, and calculus. The director says American students must perform better if the nation is to reach its goal of being the world's leader in science and math by the year 2000. For National Public Radio, this is Mark Moran in Des Moines.
President Clinton spoke at the funeral today of former Senator J. William Fulbright. Mr. Clinton worked for Senator Fulbright in the 1960s. The president credits the former Arkansas senator with molding him into the politician that he is today. On Wall Street, stock prices closed lower. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost nearly 34 points to close at 3,953. Trading was heavy. This is NPR. Congressional auditors say despite the IRS spending $2 billion in 8 years trying to update its antiquated computer system, little progress has been made. NPR's Greg Peppers reports.
The goal is to transform the IRS by the year 2000 from a labor-intensive, paper-heavy agency into a nearly paperless workplace where tax returns are filed electronically. But the General Accounting Office, Congress's investigative arm, says progress toward that goal has been minimal. IRS Commissioner Margaret Milner Richardson disputes the GAO contentions. The agency is asking Congress for $1.3 billion for its modernization program in 1996, up from $622 million this year. The project was begun in 1986 to update an IRS system that was virtually unchanged since it was first automated in the early 1960s. Congressional Republicans have expressed skepticism about the agency's request for a big budget increase for modernization. Some have even suggested that the IRS put the modernization program on hold until it can better organize its efforts. Representative Jack Kingston, a Georgia Republican, says for the IRS to spend $2 billion and have only marginal progress is criminal. I'm Greg Peppers in Washington.
U.S. and Canadian officials are checking possibly faulty seat belts in millions of Japanese cars. The Detroit News reports the belts are in more than 6 million vehicles sold in the United States and Canada. Federal regulators are investigating complaints that broken pieces of the release button could fall into the buckle's receiving end. The buckle could then unlatch in an accident. Defense Secretary William Perry says the United States has offered to sell advanced weapons like fighter jets to Poland, but no final agreement has been made on the transfer of specific weapons. Perry says the offer is also available to several Central European countries. Perry spoke at a news conference today with the Polish defense minister. Washington hasn't sold any advanced arms to former Soviet bloc states, but it signed cooperation agreements with several of them. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Dobie, wants a gal that's dreamy. Dobie, wants a gal that's dreamy. Dobie, wants a gal to call his own. Is she blonde? Is she tall? Is she dark? Is she small? Is she any kind of dream but at all?
Of the many loves of Dobie Gillis, the girl who loved him the most and the longest was Zelda Gilroy. She was brainy and aggressive, but she wasn't the dreamboat Dobie was looking for. Actress Sheila James Kuehl played Zelda from 1959 to 63. Her acting career ended shortly after the Dobie Gillis show. Now she believes no one wanted to hire her because of rumors she was a lesbian. Well, the rumors were true. When the work stopped, she went back to school, became a feminist, studied law, and put the two together. She's directed the California Women's Law Center and taught classes on gender and the law at several universities. Last November, she became the first openly gay or lesbian person to be elected to the California State Assembly. Sheila James Kuehl started acting when she was 9 and got the part of Zelda when she was 18. In 1992, I asked her what she thought of Zelda.
I loved her. I still think of her as sort of my little sister. It's interesting because once the women's movements sort of came to blossom in the 70s, I started getting a lot of letters from women who were coming to consciousness as feminists telling me that they now remembered Zelda very fondly because she was the only girl on television in all those times in the early 60s who had a brain. I mean, she not only had a brain, but she was smarter than everyone in the world. Who was aggressive, who knew what she wanted, went and got it. She was going to go to medical school. She, of course, on the other hand, she really thought it was Dobie who ought to be president of the United States. And her main aspiration was to marry him. And interestingly enough, in the reunion movies, in the first reunion movie, Zelda was in law school. In the second reunion movie, she was working in the grocery store married to Dobie. So it's just a difference, I think, between the late 70s and late 80s, just in terms of how the movie was written. And it's sort of relationship history that kind of reflects culture, I think.
Do you have a favorite Dobie episode?
I do. It was called Dobie, Dobie, Who's Got the Dobie? And it was really about Zelda being totally heartsick because Dobie won't have anything to do with her, which, of course, was the theme of their entire relationship. And he was chasing another woman. And at some point, Zelda places herself in the soda shop within full view of Dobie and this new woman, and she's wearing widow's attire, you know, black from head to foot with a veil over her face, and she's sobbing uncontrollably at this table. And Dobie comes over and he says, "Zelda, you know, you're breaking my heart. You're ruining my romance. I need you to do something for me. And if you really, really love me, you will." And Zelda says, "Anything, Poopsie. I'll do anything for you." And he says, "Smile." And she says, "Smile?" He says, "Smile." So I started smiling and he keeps saying, "Wider, wider, wider." And finally, she's got this huge grin that goes from ear to ear, which is not in her eyes. You know what I mean? This hideous grin. And she says, "I'm cracking my face." And he says, "Now laugh." And so she starts laughing. And I built up this maniacal laugh that went for almost a minute and a half, that just built up to, you know, this peak. And then she pulls out a bottle of poison and drinks it. And the show itself is, it's, I don't know, it has wonderful feeling to it. And I don't know, it's my favorite. I think it was the best work I ever did.
It's very difficult for young people to grow up on camera, which you did. But it might have been especially difficult to grow up on camera and start realizing, maybe I'm a lesbian. Because this was at a period when it was pretty socially unacceptable. There wasn't much of a gay rights movement, not much in terms of support. So did you start going through this kind of inner questioning in front of in the period when you were in front of the camera?
Terry, you're the mistress of understatement. You say there wasn't much of a movement, and it was sort of like not too cool to be queer. Yes, it was very, like, if you count losing your career, losing your family, losing the people in your religion, being fired from whatever you're doing, yeah, it was totally uncool.
Did you lose all that?
Yeah. I don't miss any of that, actually. It's the closet was just awful. I'll tell you, it was totally frightening. It was terrifying. First of all, I had no context in which to put the fact that I was falling in love with a woman. I thought it was so bizarre and so strange and so unnatural, and yet it felt so right, that I simply kept the relationship, of course, extremely, extremely, extremely secret from my parents, from everybody, never told a friend, I mean, for years. And in the third year that we were doing Dobie, Zelda was getting a lot of fan mail, and Max Schulman, and everyone loved her character. So Max wrote a pilot, a spin-off pilot, in which I would star, that featured Zelda as the lead character. And we made the pilot for the series, and CBS was extremely high on the series. And all of a sudden, the pilot just dropped like a stone, and nobody talked about it anymore. And finally, the director had the courage and compassion, I think, to take me aside and ask if we could go for a walk, and told me that there was this rumor that, well, that I was, well, you know, not straight, essentially. And it was just a rumor, and no one knew where it came from, but it was enough to get CBS to completely scotch the pilot. And I only did 4 shows the next year in Dobie, and that was it. So the homophobia in the industry, which of course only reflects how strong it is outside the industry, has devastated, I think, some careers. And to tell you the truth, I never even thought about it that much myself. I mean, people would say, "Well, why did you leave show business?" And I would make some, you know, weak joke about how, "Well, you don't leave show business. The phone just stops ringing, and that's what happened to me." And but it was homophobia.
What word did the who'd you say it was, the director who took you aside?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What word did he use for lesbian when he was talking with you? Do you remember?
Well, I think that he said, they think you're just too butch. Which, of course, is a great joke now, I think.
Well, I'm sure the irony wasn't lost on you that, you know, here you were in love with a woman and playing on TV this woman who is just addicted to Dobie Gillis.
Well, it may seem funny now, but I don't see it really. The more important, interesting thing to me, I think, was the fact that she was the strongest female character on television.
Mm-hmm.
She was capable and competent and smart, but her whole idea was she wanted to marry him and have him be successful. And what Max, I think, realized was this is not what Dobie wanted either. He wanted to be a poet. He didn't care about money. He didn't care about success. And so everybody was after something that was totally wrong for their lives in a way, which made them all losers.
Was Do you know if anybody like gossiped about you on the set or was overtly malicious? And of course, it was malicious to kind of basically throw you out of the industry. But I mean, just on a more
No, I know that no one did. Dwayne didn't know. Bob Denver didn't know. It was a total secret. I mean, no one even thought about it very much in those days.
You said before that, you know, through coming out, you lost your family and your religion. Did you?
No, no, no. I said that you could. That you run the risk of it.
But you personally
didn't. No. No, actually. But I didn't come out to my parents for 20 years after that.
It's a long time.
A long time. And, of course, my mother, bless her heart, looked at me with this sort of sad, understanding, wise look and said, "Oh, honey, we always knew you liked girls better."
Really?
Yeah.
On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we're featuring a 1992 interview with Sheila James Kuehl, who played Zelda Gilroy on The Dobie Gillis Show. Back after a break, this is Fresh Air. Sheila James Kuehl is my guest. When your acting career was ended, were you angry or disappointed? What did you feel at the time?
I think I was just mostly really sad and really scared about how I was going to earn my living. I didn't feel I had any skills that would help me earn a living. I didn't even know how smart I was. And I went back to UCLA, which is where I had graduated while I was working on Dobie in the year after, and just begged them basically for a job. I had been in the student government and loved, we weren't activists yet in that generation, but I loved that stuff and was fortunate enough to be hired working with students at UCLA, which is what eventually led to my going to law school.
How do you think you ended up becoming an activist as opposed to being a kind of bitter, injured person? You know what I mean? A lot of people who have the kind of experience...
You don't think I'm a bitter, injured person, huh?
No, a lot of people who have the kind of experience you had would perhaps never recover from it.
I don't know. I think some kind of genetic makeup that goes to humor. I'm not really sure. Every time something happens, it's devastating. I feel absolutely devastated, but it also sort of strikes me funny in a way. The sort of cosmic joke. I don't know whether I'm so evolved or what. But I guess the probably the best answer to your question is that my parents made me feel very secure, and a lot of people's parents don't. They just loved the hell out of me. And they never actually made me feel insecure by... you know, that they were critical or they thought I was going to get a swelled head. It was just fine with them if I got a swelled head when I was a kid. They thought I was terrific. And it made me feel growing up as though the most important place in my universe for confidence was really inside myself. And it really helps you bounce back from a lot of stuff.
Tell me how you started becoming involved with feminist issues and started to see yourself as a feminist.
Well, in the 70s, I was working, in the early 70s when I went to work at UCLA, I was working in an office that advises student organizations, and I was given to advise the SDS, the Progressive Labor Party, the Women's Liberation Front, the Black Student Union, and the fledgling Chicano students, because there were no people of color in my office, of course, and they didn't want very much advice, but they started sort of rolling around to my apartment late at night just to talk strategy. You know, what can I do and not get arrested? And then I would say half the point is to get arrested. And we started getting in touch in the office and in other student services offices with the fact that women students were not really getting all the services they need. Housing, psychological, medical, whatever the non-academic services were. So we called a meeting, those of us who were sort of in middle management in these student services, to talk about what women might need in these services. And it was exactly the same day as the day that I found out that I had not gotten a promotion in my office, and that a man who was hired later than I was promoted instead. And I basically got in touch with the fact that I really felt screwed over by not getting this promotion, and that I was starting to see in this, what Ms. used to call a click, I had a click. And the click was, I didn't get this promotion because I'm a woman. And I found out later that the man who denied my promotion had said, she's just too aggressive, which, of course, he did not say about the man that got the promotion. And at that point, I got really mad. And when I get mad, I get going. I have a lot of energy. So I organized a group of women to open a women's resource center at UCLA, and I'm proud to say I am the mother of the women's resource center there. And we opened it against the chancellor's orders. I almost got fired, but we did it. And we had the first women's week, I think it was 20 years ago now. It was a very exciting time, and before I knew it, I was a feminist.
Were you out then?
No, I was not out. As a matter of fact, I was going through a straight phase at that time.
Uh-huh.
I don't mean this in any funny way, but since my first lover of my whole life was a woman and it was a long-term relationship, I was curious. And I didn't sleep with any men until I was, 29 or 30. And then I decided, well, maybe I have to see what this is all about. And so I slept with a whole bunch of them. All my friends, though, no strangers, okay? And it was a wonderful time in my life.
Do you ever have the urge to act anymore?
Well, sometimes I do, mostly when I wonder how I'm going to pay the house insurance, things like that. But then every 10 years we've done a reunion movie, and both times we've done them, it has come back to me very strongly that I'm really, really, really glad that I'm doing what I'm doing now and not that.
Why?
Well, you get up at 5:30 in the morning, you go into makeup at 6 o'clock in a place with no windows, put on the makeup, go to the set, work in a place with no windows and no phone that, there's a phone, but you can't spend all day on the phone like I do, talking to people who are doing incredibly interesting and important work. You do some scenes with the effect that you're probably going to make some people laugh down the line. You don't choose the people that you're with. They're people who were cast, and they're nice enough, but, they're not necessarily political or anything. You're exhausted. You go home. You sleep. You get up, and you start over. It's essentially meaningless from the activist point of view. I think Candace Bergen is doing a great job of bringing a feminist character to to America. Designing Women does a great job in bringing up the issues and the shows they do. I think it's real important work. But I think the most that activist actresses and actors do, really, is to recognize that it's their responsibility to use their celebrity in order to anoint a cause and just show up. But you don't find any of them being the theorists or strategists for the movement, etc. They're essentially, they're celebrity. They show up.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That's not enough for me anymore.
Sheila James Kuehl, recruited in 1992. She played Zelda on The Dobie Gillis Show. Last November, she became the first openly gay person to be elected to the California State Assembly. More interviews from our archives next week at this time. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. NPR's Joanne Silberner has a profile tonight of Dr. Henry Foster, President Clinton's choice to be the new Surgeon General. Neil Conan reports on the continuing efforts by Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich to eliminate federal funds for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting for radio and for television. I'll talk with NPR's Elizabeth Arnold, covering the presidential early campaign in New Hampshire, and with Major Garrett of the Washington Times about the week just gone by in Congress. We'll have a review of a new CD-ROM based on the Barnes Foundation collection of post-impressionist painting. The CD-ROM is called A Passion for Art. And former Congressman Mickey Edwards, his views on the Christian Coalition.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Of all the routes film directors have taken toward their chosen careers, Arnie Glimcher's must be one of the strangest. He was the owner of a prominent New York art gallery selling paintings to movie producers and stars.
When director Ivan Reitman asked him to provide expertise and several prized paintings for the 1986 film Legal Eagles, Glimcher dove right in and by 1988 had become a film producer with Gorillas in the Mist and then The Good Mother. In 1992, he directed his first film, Mambo Kings, and now he's directed a second. Film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Just Cause.
Arnie Glimcher knows a work of art when he sees it, but does that make him capable of directing one? Well, Just Cause may be an unjust test case. After all, this movie aspires to be not much more than a white-knuckle thriller. And you could argue that Glimcher's most important work was done when he got Sean Connery to agree to star in it. But even with Connery lending his masterful presence, something about this movie is off almost from the beginning. The trouble is, it's too straightforward, too cut and dried. We're in a backwoods town in Florida's Everglades, and there a handsome young black man named Bobby Earle, played by Blair Underwood, is being arrested for the rape and murder of an 11-year-old white girl. Bobby Earle's sweet old grandma pleads with the evil Southern cops to leave her boy alone, but they haul him off anyway and torture him into confessing. As sadistic as the white cop is, his boss, a black police chief played by Lawrence Fishburne, is even crueler. And now, as Bobby Earle sits on death row, only days from execution, Sean Connery shows up as Paul Armstrong. He's a Harvard law professor who's against capital punishment and has reluctantly decided to take up Bobby Earle's case, putting his rusty courtroom skills where his mouth is. Lawrence Fishburne isn't too happy to see him.
This is a case that hangs together by the thinnest of threads. You see, you come down here, you start picking at them threads, now it's liable to fall apart. I don't want to see that happen. I'll tell you something else. I want to see Robert Earle go to the chair for what he did.
Tell me, what is your policy on taking guns into the interrogation room?
Very simple, we don't.
May I see your left ankle? Please.
You looking for this? I checked it with the duty sergeant.
You didn't take it out, pointed at Bobby Earle?
No, sir.
You didn't stick it in his mouth and play some Russian roulette?
No, sir.
Then how did I know where to look for it?
If all this sounds more than faintly familiar from movies as various as To Kill a Mockingbird and In the Heat of the Night, well, it is. And before Just Cause is over, we'll see ragged imitations of Cape Fear and even The Silence of the Lambs, with Ed Harris as a loony Southern cracker version of Hannibal Lecter. But when a suspense thriller is this baldly and unambiguously a fight between the good guys and the bad guys, you know that either the movie makers are simple-minded, or that we can expect big surprises ahead, which, since you expect them, might not turn out to be as surprising as the movie makers think. That didn't bother me as much as Glimcher's clumsy attempts to hard sell every twist and turn. No one can take a step into the Everglades without lots of shots of slithering alligators and backlit rattlesnakes. And this is the sort of movie in which bad guys rant and rave at the top of their lungs while Glimcher's cinematographer shines lamps underneath them to make them look spooky, like a kid with a flashlight under his chin. Through it all, Connery manfully strides, looking slightly annoyed, as though he had just detected an unpleasant odor. He has, and it's just invaded a theater near you.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person, with Alan Tu and Kathy Wolf. Research assistance from Becky Cohen. Our interns are Sienna Chrisman and Zeb Esselstyn. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.